Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Super Podcast. I am the terrible Australian Bee. I hope you're doing very well today. And with me, of course, is the one, the only Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hi, Reed. I'm well. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad. I'm quite excited at the moment because about like 14 months after I've moved in my flat, I finally have the internet in my place.
Yeah, finally you are at your apartment with the internet functioning.
Yeah, so I can, like, be, like, on the net, like, 24 hours a day instead of, like, twice a week now.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really long few weeks that you're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to getting it set up in a few weeks.
Yeah, 14 months later. There were certain setbacks, let's just say that.
That is apparent.
Of course, but we were able to get it all done in the last 3 weeks because we had to because new people were moving into the house that where my internet last internet connection was. So, so I couldn't be there anymore.
Yeah, that would be weird if the new tenants would be like, oh, why does this guy keep coming to our house for?
Hey, I was going to do that even when they're asleep at night and just, you know, sleep in one of the rooms.
That's a really good, like, exploitation movie right there.
Yeah, because it's my house, man.
This is my house.
It would probably, like, it would end up being, like, that movie, Concrete Manor, which was pretty bad, but, yeah. Yeah, if you know the plot to that movie, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Anyways, but moving right along.
Marcy, would you like to introduce our guests?
Of course. We'll introduce our guests first before I ask Marcy that question, or she asks me that question. But anyways, our guest for tonight is one of the hosts of the Screening Room podcast, and he is also has a really two really awesome websites, which is 24 frames per second, and as well as Multimedia Month, and that is, of course, our good friend from Britain, Mr. Sam Inglis. How are you going, Sam?
I am good, thank you, sir. How are you?
Oh, not too bad, thanks. I hope everything's going well for you as well.
Well, we shall see, shan't we?
Yes.
A disclaimer, I've been thrown into this this podcast very quickly, so if I'm rubbish, I have an excuse.
That is also my excuse.
Pretty much.
That's my excuse all the time, even if I am really, really prepared.
Always weird, because, you know, that's what the audience expects from me.
Yeah.
That's just how you roll.
I was going to say exactly
that's
that.
That's how I roll, man.
So, Bede, I'll ask you the magical question.
Of course.
Why are you a terrible Australian for this podcast episode?
Marcy, in theme with tonight's episode, I'm a terrible Australian because I have seen Grease 2.
But it's Grease 2. It's fun and silly.
No, it made me want to like vomit all over the place. I mean, besides like the opening number and Michelle Pfeiffer, it's like is a really crap movie.
Was it the guy in that Rex Manning?
Yes.
Yes. Oh god, yeah.
I'm and glad
even Empire Records is a better movie than Grease 2, yeah.
Indeed.
I'm glad you guys knew exactly what I was talking about when I mentioned Rex Manning.
I think we're the only people who do.
Yes, but let's just say it's Grease 2 is not as memorable as Grease, unfortunately.
Actually, I've got to say, I don't think Grease is as memorable as people think it is. It's not
band,
as good a movie as people
band,
think.
Let's your band from the podcast for life now, Sam. I'm sorry. It's Grease fan, and if you knock Grease, I will like totally disown you as a friend.
I mean, it's not as cheesy as Grease 2, but it is a cheese fest. Though, to be fair, it does not have a song about reproduction.
Okay, may not have a song about reproduction, but it makes it up by having lots of sexual innuendo dialogue.
No, I was saying that's a good thing.
Okay, that's it.
No, it's a good thing that it doesn't
happen. It's me. was laughing at Bean's confusion.
I didn't think that was difficult.
It wasn't.
My mind was elsewhere for like a second.
Bean was too busy thinking about reproduction to really know what was going
on
there.
Well, in the same context, in the same paragraph as we're talking about Michelle Pfeiffer, I can understand that being, a distraction.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm just looking at a picture of Michelle Pfeiffer right now.
Oh, dear. Do you want to move it along?
Yes, we better move it along.
So that will segue into our topic.
Yes. Our topic tonight is the top five films of 1982.
Indeed.
Which I have to say was a pretty good year for movies, if I say so myself.
Pretty solid, I would say. Yeah. Sorry, yes. That wasn't very enthusiastic, but it was a pretty decent year for films.
Yes.
Yeah, it's some good stuff.
Yeah, especially when you look, like, go to the Wikipedia page and actually look over what was released. You sit there thinking, yeah, there were some really good movies that came out. You had a couple of really shitty
I was checking that out before the podcast, and I was saying to Marcy, it's... on the box office top 10, number 10 is The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. Times have changed.
Yes.
I mean, that's... 1982 was a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Burt Reynolds and Dolly Parton, a big hit at the box office.
Yeah, and it's funny because on that documentary, Video Nasties, where they had the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas and they were trying to confiscate it without actually knowing what the movie was.
Yeah, it was the title as much as anything.
Yeah, I thought that was absolutely hilarious.
That also happened to Sam Fuller's film, The Big Red One.
Yes. All right. But we'll move right along. I think we'll start our top five. And I think for tonight's proceedings, since she picked on me last week, I think I'm going to start, have Marcy start the show for us.
All right.
What is your first choice, Marcy?
Okay. What I'll do is I'll just randomly pick from my list. I don't really particularly have them in any kind of order. So for my first one, I'm going to go with Sylvester Stallone's First Blood. Which, if people know anything, it is the very first Rambo, John Rambo film.
Yep.
And coincidentally, it came out in the same year as Rocky III. However, First Blood was a far better film. This was, I believe, Stallone wrote the screenplay as well as starred in it, and it was based on a novel. Okay, John Rambo, who's a former member of, like, the Special Forces from Vietnam, he, I think he comes back to go find one of his friends who has passed away. And as he's in this small town, he's like he's a drifter and he looks completely out of place. And the town's sheriff basically tries to run him out of town because he has, a no tolerance policy for drifters. And as this starts to happen, he doesn't end up leaving, and he basically gets harassed by the sheriff's men, and this basically leads him to try and escape from there, and they go after him, and it's basically like it's almost like a cat and mouse game between him and the sheriff's men.
Yeah.
And all the while it coincides and it parallels with what has happened.
Well, the thing is, John Rambo in the movie, like, everyone sort of knows him now as, the big, big machine gun and taking out a million guys all at once. But in First Blood, he's a very psychologically damaged character because of what happened to him in the Vietnam War.
Yeah, he's very quiet. He's not, overly ripped like he, Stallone became later. And the funny thing is, because Rambo is known for having a million deaths in every movie, this film has one, and it's almost midway through. This is more of a back and forth between everything that's happening. And you can see that this man, Rambo, is very damaged by what's happened to him. and he really has no other understanding of how to really deal with the situation.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm waiting for you to talk, and you're like, yeah.
Yeah, well, because I absolutely agree with you. Because it's kind of similar to how, like, the same thing with Rocky, you know? Like, it's just really with the sequels that Stallone sort of made them into kind of like superheroes when really in the first movie they're really sort of these down-to-earth, well, in Rocky it was sort of like this really down-to-earth character who, you know, a lot of people could relate to. And Rambo, on the other hand, is this character who was, it's basically like post-Vietnam, and it really dealt how, like I said before, that he was very psychologically damaged from the Vietnam War. And basically when the sheriff's men try to run him out of town, he practically just snaps, basically. And he, like, beats the shit out of him, attacks him, and then, and after that, the sheriff just makes it his personal mission to go get this guy, and they go into the woods. And what Rambo has learned in Vietnam, he uses against them.
Yeah, he sort of, like, sets traps and stuff for them, and he can survive in the wilderness.
Yep.
But I really, like, find that First Blood is a really interesting film, and it is an example that Stallone can act, can, you know, put on a really solid performance, and it really is almost a sad film with just the events that unfold. The sheriff, played by Brian Dennehy, I mean, he's really just an asshole by the end. Well, not by the end, by the beginning, you know, from the beginning. And it's kind of funny because one of the officers is a very young David Caruso, and I always giggle every time I see David Caruso in this movie. But I don't know if there's anything more I can really add to First Blood that hasn't been said already. And as Sam hasn't seen it, I mean, I would definitely say it would be worth just checking out, even out of curiosity, just to see what really early Stallone was like, and how different
you're going to be hearing
it's
this
come.
Probably quite a lot from me on this podcast. I've been meaning to check it out.
That's always my excuse.
the only Rambo film that I've seen is the recent one, and I've got to say, for all that Stallone built it up like it's got political content. No, it hasn't. It's just offensively violent. But this one sounds like it is more thoughtful and more sort of thematically interesting.
It
so,
is, it is,
you know,
far more
I'm,
grounded.
I'm interested.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, a complete 180 of the last Rambo film. And
well,
I think
good.
it's very much a reflection of the time. So, yeah, that was First Blood in my very awkward way of describing it.
Yes.
I'm going to have a fun editing job.
You know, you forgot one thing, Marcy.
What was that, B?
A good supply of body bags.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, well, people waiting for that one.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you this, Marcy. The director from this movie, Ted Kotcheff, you know what he would direct later on after this movie?
What would he direct later on after this movie?
Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah, that's very strange.
Yes.
Did he also make the immortal Weekend at Bernie's 2?
I think he did.
Bernie's. Anyway, that's my wrap-up on First Blood.
Yes. Sam, what is your first favourite film of 1982?
Okay, I should preface this by saying that this isn't really in any order or any sort of definitive list of, like, the top five. These are just kind of films that I like from 1982. And I'm going to start with Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, which is a relic from when Steve Martin was funny. Oh, that hallowed period. It's a film noir spoof directed by Carl Reiner. But what makes it kind of unique is that it uses clips from real noir to have Martin interact with people like Bette Davis, Barbara Stanwyck, Rita Hayworth, Jimmy Cagney, Orson Welles, Vincent Price. You know, there's so many iconic things and moments in this film where you have Steve Martin kind of interacting with something that is a pop culture memory kind of in your head. And it's, but it's done in a way that, I don't know, Forrest Gump used kind of the same trick, but in the service of very schmaltzy drama. This does it in the service of really great jokes. It's co-written by Martin and Reiner, and the way that they weave the plot, the very, very silly plot, about something called the Carlotta lists, into these clips, and the way they make it feel, even while it's being very, very funny, like a noir, in that, you know, the convoluted plot does kind of make sense, despite its silliness. And Steve Martin has this terrifically pitched, comic, hard-boiled dialogue. His relationship with Rachel Ward, who plays the femme fatale, is really nice. It's just a really smart, funny film, and also beautifully shot. The black and white is stunning. And it really looks like it could have been made in period, I think. It's a really, really interesting film. And not enough people have seen it. I don't know if you guys have caught it.
I've seen it. But I found it a kind of a disappointment. Like, I like the idea of, like, having Steve Martin basically interacting in a film that basically is... has him interacting with basically actors who were making these type of sort of noir films around that time, like clips of them, and edited in together into the film. So you can sit there, you sit there and watch it, and it's like how it's edited together and also how it's written. It seems like he's having a conversation with somebody like Humphrey Bogart or James Cagney. But like there are some funny moments in it, but I felt like it wasn't as funny as it could have been. Like, I do agree with you. It is a beautifully shot film. The black and white is spectacular. But I don't know. It just didn't really deliver much on the comedy front. Like, it's a really good idea. But I think it just needed to be a bit more funnier.
I've got to say, it's not The Man with Two Brains, which I think is one of the funniest films ever made, which Martin and Reiner would make the next year. But I still think it's... I mean, for me... Everyone goes on about The Jerk when they talk about Steve Martin and Carl Reiner and Steve Martin's early career. And though I think The Jerk is kind of funny, I think they bettered it several times, actually, with all their other films. So, you know, I would definitely recommend this one if you're interested in Martin's early career.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of familiar with it, but I think it's something I'd want to just sit down and watch eventually.
Mm.
So, yeah. I mean, you've convinced me.
I think it's also something that it's really instructive to have seen some of the films that are excerpted in it before you sit down and see it. I mean, I haven't actually seen, I think it's called The Alibi, which is the main film that it's kind of constructed from, the one that's features Vincent Price. And there are quite a few others that I haven't seen, but it helps if you've seen The Killers and White Heat and The Big Sleep and things like that to sort of go, oh, right. But yes, I mean, that's Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, I suppose.
My first pick, as which film I would like to talk about from 1982, I like to pick Werner Herzog's Fitzcarraldo.
Fitzcarraldo. Sorry.
Fitzcarraldo.
Sorry, I just wanted to say that.
That's all right. I actually saw this film last year, and it's a completely amazing film in a lot of ways. It basically follows a guy named Brian Sweeney Fitzgerald, played by Klaus Kinski. But the thing is, all the the locals can't pronounce his last name properly, so they just call him Fitzcarraldo. And he sort of lives in South America, trying to start up a rubber factory. Well, yeah, actually, he has a dream of... One of the things he loves in the film is he loves the opera. And one of his dreams is that he wants to, where he lives, in the jungle, he wants to open up an opera house. But his sort of ice factory isn't going anywhere. But he finds out that if he wants to make money to make this this opera house, that he needs to go into another business. And a friend of his suggests he should try the rubber business, because rubber is like one of the biggest exports in the country at that time. And one of his a friend of his shows him that there's an untapped resource of trees that make rubber somewhere deep in the jungle, and it's really hard to get there because of rocky rivers and mountains and all that. So he gets a boat together and a crew, and he sets off across down the river to these rubber trees, and it pretty much follows his journey along there, meeting up coming across like other tribesmen, and it's hard to describe this film in a way, because I think it's definitely, it based on my experience with it, it's definitely one of the most optimistic films I have ever seen, because basically the main theme is that don't let, you know, go out and follow your dreams no matter how big they are, basically. And I think that's what he wants to do. And when he heads out on this journey to fill his dreams. But one of the things that the film is best known for is definitely the image of his boat being carried across a mountain, which is used in the poster. And pretty much any time you see a picture of this film, that's the first image they show. And it's a completely inspiring film. And you sit there thinking, you can't believe that. Well, you can kind of believe it, because Werner Herzog's kind of an insane person anyway, that this man actually went out into South America and made a film and actually made a boat and got these people to help carry it over this mountain. And you're like just stunned at how it was accomplished. And it truly is an amazing film. And it's definitely one of my favorite Werner Herzog film. Like, I haven't seen many, but I have seen a couple to know of what type of films that he has made. But this, for me, is like his masterpiece, and without a doubt, the best film that I have seen that I have seen so far. What do you guys think of this Corraldo?
Really comment.
I haven't actually seen Fitzcarraldo, I'm afraid.
Oh. I'm very surprised for both of you.
It's going to be... but I really want to, and I particularly want to see Burden of Dreams as well, which is the film about the making of the film and the pure insanity of Werner Herzog. I mean, this is the film on which he apparently considered an offer from some of his extras to murder Klaus Kinski for him.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been fascinated definitely by Herzog, and I sort of have memories of this movie, but it's like I need to sit down and just watch the whole thing. And I think almost like he said, he's so crazy, and just I can imagine how this production of this film was so difficult, and the relationship between Herzog and Kinski. I think it's almost the stuff of legend by now. So it's definitely something I really just want to, you know, find that time, remember first of all, and just sit down and watch the film, and then follow it on with the subsequent documentaries.
Yeah, I've been wanting to check out Burden of Dreams, so I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for that. And I definitely, I don't know if it's out on Blu-ray yet, but if it's not, it's definitely a must-buy for me if it does. And if you love this movie, you should also... another film of his that I guess you can, in a way, you can consider as a companion piece, which is Aguari, The Wrath of God, which is fantastic. An amazing film as well. They're kind of... Both these films are kind of similar, because he's about pretty much expeditions down the South America, down the Amazon. But let's just say that Aguari sort of ends on guests kind of a downer note, while Fitzcarraldo more ends on a happier note. And it, like I said before, it really is one of the most optimistic films I have ever seen. it actually really does inspire you. Pretty much shows like no dream could ever be too big.
Mm.
Or in this case, Werner Herzog's dream was to have a boat taped carried over a mountain. And he accomplished that, so.
Mm.
But it's interesting, like I said, it's a production, like, just to see the documentary. And I just keep thinking how different this movie could have been, because before Klaus was cast in the film, Jason Robards was originally going to play the part and actually shot scenes. And Mick Jagger was also cast in the film as to play his assistant. And it was going to be entirely in English, language. Mm. But Jason Robards got sick. And so he got recast with Klaus Kinski, and Mick Jagger had to go on tour with the Rolling Stones. So his character was written out of the film altogether.
Just to say, Bede, if you're interested, there's a release over here that has both Fitzcarraldo and Burden of Dreams, and can easily be had really very cheaply. So it might be worth looking on UK Amazon for that.
Yeah, sure. I'll have to have a look for that, because I definitely want to buy both film and as well as Burden of Dreams. Like, even though I haven't seen it yet, but I know it's going to be just based on an amazing documentary. So yeah,
I hear it's one of the best filmmaking documentaries ever made. So yeah,
I'll have to check that out. So yeah, Fitzcarraldo. If you haven't, for our listeners out there, if you haven't seen it, definitely go out and watch it, because I think it's definitely probably might inspire you in a way, like it did for me. So, yeah.
We'll add it to the list again.
So, Marcy, what's your second pick?
All right. I'm going to go with a little film called Poltergeist, which was...
We're here!
I was going to get to that. It's a horror movie, which was a Steven Spielberg produced, directed by Tobe Hooper, which, of course, had the... controversy as to whether Tobe Hooper did all of the directing, as rumors would state that, you know, Spielberg really did direct it, but, you know, I don't know, it's what people like to just kind of make shit about, I suppose.
I'd personally like to believe that Steven did somewhat direct it, because everything else that Tobe Hooper did after this movie was completely shit, so yeah.
Mm.
What little I know about it, because I haven't seen the film, it does look, from what I've seen of it, incredibly Spielbergian.
Mm.
I mean, just that very famous still of the kid sitting in front of the telly with it sort of glowing at. I mean, that's a Spielberg image through and through.
Mm. The interesting thing to note was during the time of the making of this film, it was coinciding with E.T., and Spielberg was apparently under a clause where he was not able to do any directing while E.T. was going on. So it's, you know, there's so much to be said about what was really going on behind the scenes. But as for the film itself, it's an interesting, you know, little horror movie basing itself around like a house. I think it's in California, and there's a family that are in this house. And I think that strange things start happening. I believe the young daughter starts sort of going up to the television, and it just shows static. And then there's like an earthquake, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yep.
And then, of course, she makes the remark, "They're here." And after that, all the strange events start to happen in the house, which, if you've seen, you know, Paranormal Activity or something else like that, I guess it would be more like Paranormal Activity 2, because moved things around and everything in the kitchen came crashing and stuff like that.
Yep.
Just an example, because, you know, I don't know if people are very familiar with a lot of ghost movies.
Poltergeist has influenced a lot of ghost stories.
Yeah, it has. But I'll just use that as an example. So, yeah, strange things start happening, like a ghostly presence. And as they try and investigate what's going on, the young daughter gets kidnapped. And the mother makes it her mission to try and rescue her And that's really about all I should really reveal. If you've seen the Simpsons episode where Homer is in 3D, there's a lot of references to Poltergeist in that one, which would sort of give a good idea because, the whole trying to rescue sequence with Homer reflects how they try to rescue the daughter in this movie. And, you know, the whole Poltergeist franchise has always been a subject of a lot of controversy, and it was said to have a curse, which is, you know, too much things have happened to really get into. But for its time, I mean, it had really good effects. I think it was nominated for an Oscar for visual effects, I can remember.
It was free nominations.
Mm, it had a great score. It was, you know, all the actors did such a great job, and it was just a really interesting and almost fun film because there's a real adventure at hand, even though it is within the house. But, you know, I think it is definitely worth checking out as just seeing, like, you know, a horror movie that doesn't rely on, you know, physical killing of people or stuff like that. It is more psychological and, you know, you don't, it's sort of less is more approach in regards to some of the things that are happening. So if you haven't seen it, it is really worth checking out. It's a great little film, and I really need to revisit it again.
I second that. It's a great film. I haven't seen it for a number of years, but I have been itching to go back and rewatch it. It is out on Blu-ray as we speak, we should say. So maybe it might be.
Do I want to see it on Blu-ray? Because maybe seeing it in the way I did on VHS would be fun to do anyway.
I suppose so, but, you know, that could be. But who knows? Maybe the picture quality is amazing.
It could be, but it had a really just raw feel to it. Back in the day, but you know, that's me.
Yeah, but I do agree. It's a really creepy and a really well made horror movie. The casts were all great. I do have to give a shout out to Zelda Rubinstein, who plays the psychic who the family of the house hired to help get rid of the ghosts that are in the house. She was really great in the movie too, and she sort of became sort of a cult figure after that, because she appeared in a lot of horror movies, and she has a very recognizable voice. Like, if you hear it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But, yeah, Poltergeist, I agree, it's a great film and worth checking out.
And I believe, Sam, you didn't see it?
As I say, I haven't actually caught up with it yet, which is shameful, I understand.
We have our recommendations now.
But, yeah, I mean, It's something I've been meaning to see. And also there's a lot of interesting stuff behind the scenes sort of after the making of the film, isn't there? Because there's this whole idea, spurious idea, of course, but like The Omen, that it's cursed.
Yeah, with a lot of deaths occurring.
A lot of people associated it with it died, and particularly the young girl who stars in it, I think Heather O'Rourke. I think she was only 12 when she died. And you know, it's kind of become legendary in that respect as well.
I mean, it is really an interesting film to revisit, and just knowing a lot of the, you know, that stuff, I think almost adds to it now when you look back and watch it.
I mean, I think I'll definitely get around to checking it out at some point. I just kind of haven't.
I know where you're coming from.
Too many films to watch, you know.
Yeah, too many films, so little time. So that's Poltergeist.
Yes, Sam, what is your second pick?
Okay, well, let's go with a couple of comedies, because I want to talk about a couple of very similar teen comedies from 1982. The first one being the classic Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I mean, people who know me, or people who've heard me on the various shows I do, will know my love for this movie and my love for its cast. It's just a really terrifically entertaining teen movie. It's very, very funny. It's obviously got fantastic dialogue because it's written by Cameron Crowe. It's got a really great sort of 80s pop soundtrack, you know, the Go-Go's and stuff like that, though obviously Somebody's Baby notwithstanding. And it's got a fantastic cast of a lot of very talented and very young people, many of them making their debuts. I mean, you've got, from the lead roles, you've got Phoebe Cates and Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Sean Penn, of course, playing Spicoli, which suggests he should do more comedy. But even in cameos, you've got people like Nick Cage, you've got Forrest Whitaker popping up. You know, it's really just stuffed with talent. I like the fact that it's an American teen movie that kind of engages with some sort of harsher issues as well as being a kind of knockabout sex comedy, because it definitely is that. And, you know, it does that in a quite sort of confrontational R-rated way, with the particularly memorable scene of Phoebe Cates getting out of the pool in Judge Reinhold's Fantasy. I mean, that's a scene that the director, Amy Heckling, notes on the commentary. Whenever she would rent the video of the film, when you could still rent videos, that scene would be fuzzy and the tracking would go out. and you, know, you can totally appreciate why.
Yes. As a guy, I enjoy that scene a lot, but that's a whole different story altogether. But anyways, continue.
Thank you for giving us that insight into your personal life. That's very good.
Well, pretty much that scene made every boy into a man when they first saw it.
There it's is true. That. And, but I've got to say, even from the first time I saw it, and maybe it's because I was already a fan, but I was like, yeah, I kind of prefer Jennifer Jason Leigh's scene in the changing room, though. Because, but anyway. So there's that film, which does sort of the combination of, you know, sort of sex comedy and more serious drama, particularly with Jennifer Jason Leigh's character, Stacey. It does that quite well. It combines the two kind of throughout the film. It deals with, you know, the sort of fraught relationship between Stacey and the, I forget his name right now, Ratner. Mal Ratner, the sort of nerdy kid who's always trying to pick her up. There's that wonderful scene when they go on a date together and he accidentally plays her the wrong Led Zeppelin tape. So he's got Kashmir playing as you're going to this date. It's brilliantly doom-laden. But there's also another film that is almost totally unknown from 1982, which kind of does similar thing, called The Last American Virgin. And that's a remake of an Israeli film called Lemon Popsicle, which was actually by the same director, Bias Davidson. And it doesn't do it quite so well. You know, in this one, it's not combining the comedy and the drama throughout. It's more sort of, it's an hour of knockabout sex comedy and then suddenly cuts to 40 minutes of drama. Mm. But even though it does it a bit more clunkily, it kind of does it with a lot of charm, and both parts of the film work rather nicely independently of each other. Mm-hmm. I'm not claiming it as any sort of masterpiece. It certainly has problems, particularly that the lead actor really doesn't have the dramatic chops to quite carry off the second half of the film. But it isn't without charm, and it certainly deserves to be a bit better known than it is. It's got a kind of cult following because of Diane Franklin, who is kind of a cult 80s actress. She was one of the princesses in Bill and Ted, and she was she's in Better Off Dead as well with John Cusack. And she is charm itself and cuteness itself in this movie. And naked, also, just throwing it out there, by the way. It's a clunky film. It doesn't quite work, but I kind of liked it, you know? I would definitely say see Fast Times first, see Fast Times repeatedly. I know it's coming to Blu-ray here soon, and I can't wait to pick it up. But the fact that The Last American Virgin hasn't been released in this country, in the UK, since 1987, that seems unfair. It's a much better film than that, and it's well worth a look if you're kind of interested in teen movies like I am. I really think they're not given their due quite often for being interesting, and yeah, it's kind of a fun one.
You've convinced me I would like to check it out.
I agree. I've actually seen it too, Tim. I do agree with you. It does feel clunky and a bit uneven at times, but I think both the sort of the comedic elements of the film, like the comedic first half and the sort of dramatic last half of the film, actually do work regardless if they do feel slightly clunky and uneven at times.
Yeah.
And also, too much spoilers. Let's just say that one of the reasons is this film is at least famous in the sort of the 80s teen world is because of its ending, which I won't spoil, but let's just say it doesn't end quite the way you would expect a sexy teen comedy of the 80s would end.
No, I've got to say, I really like the ending.
Me too.
I think that ending to me feels much more like the teenage years that I remember myself and my friends having than the ending of most teen movies.
It's more like reality-based, that ending.
Mm-hmm.
One of our friends of the show, AJ, he really does not like this movie.
I was talking to him about it, and he really hates it, much the same reasons that we're praising it, actually.
Yeah. And because I think one of the main ones was the ending, from what I recall when I was talked to him about it a while ago. But, it is an ending that I think I can understand why people would hate the ending, because it's not how a lot of people would expect a film like this to end. But I liked it because of the way it ends, because it does something different and unexpected.
Totally, yeah.
Yes. And I do agree. If you haven't seen The Last American Virgin, it's definitely worth checking out.
I shall check it out eventually.
And I like Fast Times. I actually did really like the soundtrack to this film as well.
To Last American Virgin. Oh, I hate the soundtrack in Last American Virgin, I've got to say. Well, the soundtrack's really pretty awful.
Oh, well, I like the soundtrack because, you know, it's got a lot of cool songs.
Though I do like the Devo track.
Oh, well, everyone loves that track.
That's fucking awesome.
Yes. We'll move on. I guess we'll move on to me now. My next pick, as soon as I can get the Wikipedia page up. My next pick is a film from 1982, of course. It's a film I actually watched probably a couple of months ago, and I actually wrote a mini review for it for supermarcy.com's sort of recommendations of the week. And that film which I'm talking about is White Dog. It's a film, it tells the story of a young actress named Julie, who was played by Christy McNichol, a.k.a. the Lindsay Lohan of the 80s. And she's an actress, and one night when she's sort of driving home, she accidentally runs over a German Shepherd, a white German Shepherd. And so she takes it to the vet to get him looked at, and sort of hear, like, no owner doesn't claim the dog within a few days, the dog will be put down. So she decides to adopt the dog and claim it as her own. And so time sort of goes on, and her and the dog get on very well and love each other. But the thing is, she takes the dog to a movie set one day. And while she's doing a scene with a friend of hers who's African-American, the dog attacks her. And at first, Julie's not sure why on earth this dog, which is always friendly all the time, suddenly attacked her friend. And then eventually she discovers that this is not the first time that the dog has attacked other people. She discovers that while she goes to an animal trainer to find out what is wrong with the dog, she discovers that her dog is a white dog, which is a dog that has been trained to attack and kill black people. And then she, while at the sort of this animal training center, she meets a man by the name an African-American man by the name of Keys, played by Paul Winfield, who kind of makes it his personal mission to basically reprogram the dog so he no longer attacks black people. And it's a really interesting movie. Like, I wouldn't say it's a perfect film, but it's a very interesting film that takes a different look at racism, and it sort of takes a look whether it, racism is something that we learn all the we learn as we get older, or is it something that we're just born with, and whether we can be deprogrammed not to be that anymore. It's a very interesting film, and also it's also very intense. Like, the dog attack sequences in this film are very intense and very violent, but it's very well performed. Like, Paul Winfield does a really great job in the film as Keyes. Christy McNichol is kind of on and off at times. Like, she is the weak link of the film, but it's not enough to the fact that she ruins the movie. But it's a really interesting film. Definitely one of the most interesting films that I have seen that have actually dealt with racism. And what's interesting about the film, like Poltergeist, it had a very interesting backstory. When the film came out, sort of African-American groups thought the film was promoting racism, which it clearly is not. But at the time, the movie, and because of sort of the controversy of that, the film barely got a release in the US. Like, it was released at a few cinemas, and basically it was put on the shelf for a very long time. Like, it was released every now and again, but only for film festivals and whatnot. And it really didn't finally get a proper DVD release until a couple of years ago, where the Criterion Collection picked it up and released it on their label, which you can go out and buy now. And also, because of the controversy, the film's director, Sam Fuller, who we were talking about earlier with the Big Red One, he directed this film, and because of sort of the controversy surrounding this film, he left the US and never made another film in the United States ever again due to the backlash that this film received. And like I said, it's a really great movie. Ennio Morricone also does the score for this film, and it's a really great score. It's definitely worth checking out. And if you guys haven't seen it, definitely see it. It's a really interesting movie. Like I said, it's not perfect, but it's a movie that I think everyone should see. Have you guys seen What Dog?
No, I haven't.
Of all the stuff we've talked about, this is the one I'm desperate to see. I've wanted to see it for years. It's a really interesting concept. And the debate behind its meaning, you know, whether it's racist or anti-racist, blah, 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 fascinating. You know, I always find that kind of thing really interesting because, I mean, it came up around something like American History X as well, because when you depict vicious racism like that, there is definitely a chance that some people are going to just go, he's depicting vicious racism, he must think that's okay, and it's always interesting to look at those sorts of issues, I think, as a viewer, as a critic. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this.
I do agree with you, Sam. I do like movies that sort of take the sort of really a subject, whether it be racism or whatnot, and put it in a film that you wouldn't expect it to be in. And just like this one, like, you show racism in the form of a guy trying to basically reprogram a dog not to be racist anymore. And it's a really fascinating film. Like I said, it's not perfect, but it's definitely just worth checking out for sure. And since I assume since it's released by Criterion, that would have like an amazing load of extras along with it. And I also love the cover that they have for the movie. It's very simple, but it's completely awesome. And like I said before, the book it's based on a book by Romain Gary, and it was based on an incident that actually did happen to him in real life. So yeah, so white dogs do actually exist in this world, and yeah, and also, just looking on the Wikipedia page, two things point out. One of the co-writers of the film, because Samuel Fuller co-wrote the script with a future Oscar-winning writer-director, Curtis Hanson, who would later go on to make L.A. Confidential. And I just looked on here that it would have been a completely different movie, that the original director of the film was going to be Roman Polanski. So you can imagine what type of a how interesting of a film that it would have been if Roman Polanski did make this film. But I think Samuel Fuller does a really amazing job with this film. Like, there's a bit of sort of a melodrama, bit of a thriller in there, but it works really well as, like, what's the word I'm looking I'm trying to figure out this
I've got to say, as much as I want to see Sam Fuller's film, I kind of want to see Roman Polanski's as well.
I know, I can only just imagine what his film version of this would have been like. But he was going to direct it, but then, you know, he had to leave the country for obvious reasons. Which we won't go into, because that's a completely different story altogether. But it's a really fascinating film, and definitely check it out. And you guys should check it out right after this podcast if you haven't. Marcy, what is your third pick?
All right, mine is a little movie called Tron. And funnily enough, with the last movie I mentioned having been referenced heavily on The Simpsons, in that very same sequence, Tron was actually heavily referenced. So that's pretty funny. But anyway, Tron is about... off the top of my head. All right, so...
computer.
Yeah, so we got Kevin Flynn, played by Jeff Bridges, who's like a software engineer. And he is very, very smart man. And the guy in charge, Mr. Dillinger, played by David Warner, has apparently stolen a lot of Flynn's like codes and stuff for what his company Encom have released, like games and stuff. And Flynn is trying to expose Dillinger for having done that to him. So upon trying to hack in, his two friends, Alan Bradley and I think it's Laura, played by Bruce Boxleitner and Cindy Morgan, help Kevin get into Encom so he can actually hack the system within the building. While he does that, he gets teleported inside the computer mainframe, inside the grid. Everything looks kind of funky. And basically, Kevin Flynn is a user, while everybody else in there is a program. And he comes across... he comes across some programs that help him, including one that looks like his friend Alan, called Tron. And they try and basically overthrow the MCP, which is the Master Control Program, which on the grid looks like Dillinger. So it's basically one big crazy adventure. It's a lot of fun. It was pretty much a film that was ahead of its time. There was, I think, the first, or if not one of the first films to use computer animation for inside the grid. And... I can't remember what I was going to say. So that's Tron.
Well, that wasn't really good. And I have discussed this on the podcast before, because we reviewed Tron when Tron Legacy came out.
And my explanation was absolutely horrendous this time around, but I think you get the drift.
Yeah, I thought I covered it with Man Gets Sucked Into Computer.
I was trying to get a little more in depth for whatever reason.
Maybe more specific, I guess.
Yeah.
But no, in all seriousness, I still am of the same opinion, really. I think Tron's an interesting and groundbreaking film, and it's definitely very ahead of its time. I think the problem with Tron Legacy is that it doesn't seem to advance. It's perhaps of its time or a little behind its time. It is not, you know, something that you think has ideas that are 15 years away from being reality. Whereas Tron certainly was.
Tron's definitely been a major inspiration for a hell of a lot of films that have come out since.
Well, I wasn't even really talking about films, but sort of the real world and the way we live too, now, online and things. Mm. It's a film that kind of envisions much of that, though to a sort of greater degree. I love the look of it, you know, even with the dated nature of the blockiness of the graphics, I think it's really striking looking still. And I think there are some really solid performances in there. So, yeah, I mean, surprisingly, for a film that has CGI that is now 29 years old, it really holds up.
It actually looks really, really nice on Blu-ray.
We do have the Blu-ray. I haven't watched it yet.
It doesn't look hokey or anything. I mean, you can understand that this is what things looked like back then. But it actually looks very sharp and crisp. It doesn't look at all silly. And they did a really great job. I know they worked on, fixing it up. And yeah, I think that's why they put off the re-release for as long as they did. And it does look quite great on Blu. So
I've got to say, I'll definitely revisit this film.
But yeah, that's Tron.
Yes.
I don't know if Bede wants to add anything else. My explanation was so awkward of that, and I apologize to the listeners for having to listen to me explain Tron.
Hey, it was much better than every explanation I've ever been trying to give to a film since I've been on this show. But I do agree. I really enjoyed Tron. It's definitely a film that I really want to go back and watch, because I really enjoyed Tron Legacy a lot, and I definitely need to check the first one out again. But I'd have to make sure it'd be on Blu-ray, because I can only imagine that this one would look stunning on Blu-ray.
Yeah, it definitely it's worth getting on Blu-ray. I mean, I don't think you can really get it on DVD anymore, but it is something that, you know, really does suit that format. Yep. It upgrades it quite well. So, yeah, anyway, that's Tron, and Jeff Bridges is the man.
Sam, what is your third pick?
Well, see, there's a possibility that I might be cheating here, and I will turn this over to the panel of judges. Blade Runner, but Blade Runner, the final cut, because the 1982 version with the voiceover, no thank you.
Mm. I would say it's fair enough, because the film originally was released in 82, so I think you can go and discuss, the final cut would be acceptable.
Yeah, I agree.
So the judges have ruled in my favour, so we can continue. Would have been a short item if we hadn't, but we'll gloss over that part of the decision. Thank you. Justices Jermaine and Papandrea. Okay, so Blade Runner is a film that I have kind of an interesting relationship with, because I saw it first when I was first at college, so when I was about, 18, 19. And I couldn't get through it. I fell asleep several times while watching it. And yet I still wrote an essay on it and got a B, by the way. Thank you. But yeah, I couldn't get through it until a couple of years ago. The final cut came out on DVD, and I just thought, I really should give this another go. It's been a while. It's a new version. Oh, that's what I was missing. Blade Runner is a fantastic film. It's visually stunning. It has one of the most fully realized visions of the future that I think we've ever seen on film. It has a terrifically engaging sort of noirish story, and it has emotion behind it. I think it's a really tremendous, almost visionary piece of work, just in the design that Ridley Scott and Sid Mead and the sort of the team behind the look of the film put together. I don't think we're going to see the world turn into Blade Runner the way that we might have thought we would in 1982. I mean, it's not far away now, 2019. And I don't think we're going to have the flying cars and the neon-lit streets or anything. But
what a shame.
It's a fantastically interesting vision of the future anyway. Hmm. Oh, don't we all want a flying car? Yeah.
I know.
We're meant to be getting them in 4 years' time, says Back to the Future 2, but I don't think that's going to happen. Anyway, it's also just a really engaging character piece. Harrison Ford giving one of his best performances as Death Card, who is this Blade Runner, essentially a private detective tracking down these escaped humanoid robots called replicants, and he's got to track down a group of escaped replicants led by Rutger Hauer in the film. And what's really interesting, I think, about Blade Runner is the sort of the way that Deckard and Roy Batty, Rutger Hauer's character, kind of parallel each other, and kind of the way that they finally meet and interact in, I think, one of the great ending scenes of 1980s cinema. You know, Rutger Hauer and his improvised speech about memories being lost like tears in rain is just an incredibly moving thing when you consider his character and the fact that he is this, you know, enslaved robot who has a, you know, a built-in guaranteed short lifespan. And to bring that sort of emotional content to what essentially, at its most basic level, is really just kind of a schlocky piece of sci-fi noir is really something very special. I mean, if you break down Blade Runner to its most basic level, it is kind of schlock. But Ridley Scott, Harrison Ford, Rutger Hauer, they all bring such passion to it and such meaning to it that you kind of, that it takes on another level, I think. And that's what I saw in it that I didn't see the first time when I watched the final cut. And also just the fact that on that DVD with that cleaned up print, it is so astonishingly beautiful. I can't wait to pick up the Blu-ray and see how that looks. But even on DVD, it is jaw-dropping to look at. I'm a real convert to this film, and I think it's actually, I've seen this as a pattern among other people that I've talked to as well. It kind of takes two or three viewings before you sort of wake up to Blade Runner as kind of a work of genius. But I definitely think it is one.
I agree too,
and I do agree on your assessment here. Like, I think everyone who saw Blade Runner the first time would agree that they just, I guess, would find it boring the first time they watched it. But it's not until you probably see it a second or third time that you kind of, it finally clicks and you realize that, that this is an amazing film. And especially for me, because I actually thought it was okay the first time I watched it. The second time I watched it, I thought, okay, that's pretty good. And it wasn't until the third time I actually bought the Blade Runner box set when it came out, the final cut that came out a couple of years ago. I watched that, and that's when I just realized that this is an amazing movie. And I also bought the Blu-ray as well, which I had been meaning to watch as well, because I hear that the Blu-ray transfer for Blade Runner is like one of the best ever done, from what I've heard.
I really want to pick up the Final Cut Blu-ray. I'll probably get the 2-disc of that and hold on to my 5-disc DVD box set.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to be doing as well. But I do agree. I think what really got to me about this film, as you said, is the Rutger Hauer character. It's interesting watching the film now when you kind of realize that he's a very interesting villain. Actually, the replicants in this film are very interesting villains when you sort of look back at it, because then what they're doing is that they're not going out to destroy the world or the universe and whatnot. What they're doing in this film, all they want to do is they want to live longer.
Yeah.
That is... It's interesting because
you talk about Batty as the villain, and he's clearly cast in that role.
Yeah.
You know, he's the film's antagonist to a certain degree.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's really a villain. I don't think Scott or the writers see him as a villain. He's Deckard's job, and Deckard is the protagonist. Yeah. But if you made Batty the protagonist, Deckard is the villain, and is almost a more suitable villain.
Yeah, I do agree. Like, I'm sort of saying, you know, like, the quote-unquote villain of the film.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Like, yeah, like, I do love it when sci-fi films, and I was saying about this on the last podcast about AI, artificial intelligence, is that what makes some of these films, especially Blade Runner, so amazing, is that they have this sort of element to them that we all could that had this sort of universal theme that we could all relate to. With, I was saying, with AI, it's about a child wanting their mother's love, while in this film, it's wanting to live longer. And I think everyone could relate to that in some way. Because, like, if you were put in a situation with these replicants where you basically know exactly the moment where you're going to shut down, wouldn't you want to live longer? Because there's so many things that you would want to do and to see that you don't have the time to do it, because that's not how you were built to be. You were supposed to be alive for a certain amount of time and then shut down for good. And I can really see why Roy Batty in the film is doing what he does. And I think a lot of people, when they sort of watch it, especially after a few times, they can really sense that and realize that, like, even though he's, I guess, like I say, he's supposed to be the quote unquote villain, but he's much more complex and much more interesting as that. And they can see, and the audience, us as the audience, can see, we can understand why he's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really interesting film, and that really explores that theme. And like you say, it's like just the visual style of this film is absolutely amazing. And and especially in the last couple of years, a lot of sci-fi films have taken that sort of just the production have been influenced by Blade Runner in a lot of ways in its production design.
It's incredibly influential, but it's also incredibly liberally stealing from sci-fi across the years. I mean, you can't imagine Blade Runner without Metropolis, for example.
Yeah,
I mean,
I agree. It sort of takes it to a whole new level. Like, it's influenced by Metropolis and other films, but it does it in a way that feels fresh and new. Like, mm-hmm. something that you watch it and you think, oh, wow, I've never seen anything like this before.
Well, just the opening shot is absolutely extraordinary. That image of eyes superimposed over this exploding city. From the first image, and I don't know how it didn't affect me in this way the first time, but from that first image, you're just drawn into this incredibly stylized and beautiful world that you've really never seen to that sort of degree before.
Yeah.
It's a stunning, stunning movie to look at.
It is. And it has one of the great, questions of all time, and the spoilers. I don't know why I should say spoilers, because this movie's been out for nearly 30 years now. What the hell haven't you people seen it? But I'm going to say it anyway. one of the great questions of all time in films is Deckard a replicant or not?
Yeah, I've got to say, I've never, even as I've become a fan of the film, I've never quite seen, I guess, I'm not particularly interested in that answer, I've got to say. And I still don't get the unicorn dream. Ridley, you can kind of fuck off with that one. But yeah, I mean, I don't know that it particularly matters whether Deckard is a replicant. I know there's a deep division of opinion. Certainly, Ridley Scott says absolutely yes, and Harrison Ford says absolutely not. I don't know how important it is, actually.
Yeah, it's sort of one of those.
I'm getting nailed about that.
Well, I think the unicorn does have its purpose, but I'd have to go into more of that. But we can just talk about a little bit about that after the show. But but yeah, it's one of the great questions. Like, I have my own opinions on that question, but that'd be an entirely different discussion altogether. So Marcy.
Yes.
Well, what are your thoughts on Blade Runner?
I don't know if there's anything else I can add to what you've both said. So.
Well, we should say I haven't had a chance to watch all of it yet, but if you love Blade Runner, definitely check out the making of documentary Dangerous Days.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I haven't even gone through that. It's quite long, but I went to sit down and watch it once, and then I didn't finish it. Sorry.
There's a lovely bit towards the end where they've got people talking about which is their favourite version, and as much as I don't like it or I didn't like it, I want to go back and see the original version again, because Guillermo del Toro, who I have endless respect and admiration for, says that the original version with the voiceover is his favorite version, and that, he really loves and needs to hear that voiceover. Really, dude? Okay. Mm. I'm going to have to check it out again on the basis of that, because Guillermo del Toro is an incredibly smart man who knows his movies.
Mm.
Exactly.
That's interesting, yeah.
Okay, I guess it's my turn again.
Yep.
Where's my list? Okay.
I've gotten already.
My final choice. Oh, well, not my final. My first choice, should I say.
Jesus, Pete.
You have third choice. I'm terrible. I blame all this on somebody. But anyway.
So your third pick.
My final choice.
No, not your final choice. I thought we just established this.
Your third choice.
Okay. Why I'd say final. All right. My third choice is Sophie's choice.
Why are we laughing?
Because I like went from my next choice to Sophie's choice.
You were getting confused.
Sophie's choice, it's a laugh riot.
It's the most hilarious movie ever made.
Of course.
Not really.
Yes. Well, not really, because it's a really, really sad story. It stars Meryl Streep, who plays a woman named Sophie, and it follows her in 1947 after she's a Polish immigrant who has left Europe after World War II. And so she comes to live in Brooklyn, and she moves in with this man named Nathan, played by Kevin Klein, and they sort of become lovers. But then a young guy named Stingo, who's played by Peter MacNicol, who comes to Brooklyn, and he moves in with them. And it basically sort of follows their lives as he's staying with both of them. And as well as during the course of the movie, he starts to really get to know Sophie, and he starts to sort of fall in love with her. And also, it's one of those movies you can't really say too much about, because the title of the movie, Sophie's Choice, kind of means two things, but I won't say what they are. Well, what they are, because, you know, they'll venture in the spoiler territory. But it's one of those films that you should check out without knowing too much about it, because where it goes into some really interesting directions, and it sort of has this sort of goes into sort of the backstory of Sophie and how much tragedy she has suffered in her life. And what, for me, one of the main things that made this film really great for me was Meryl Streep, who definitely gives one of the great performances ever seen on films. Well, one of the best that I've ever seen. She's absolutely amazing in this film. She just does her performance perfectly. Yes, she does do her trademark, you know, accent, because, you know, she does a lot of accents, but she does her Polish accent very well, but she brings a lot of subtlety, a lot of beauty to the role, and she is quite amazing. And also Kevin Klein and Peter MacNicol are also really good as well. It's a long film, like it is about 2.5 hours long, and it's very deliberately slow paced, but it's a film that during the course of while I was watching it, I absolutely sort of fell in love with. And it's a tearjerker, but it's still a very well crafted film, beautifully directed, beautifully acted, and just beautifully written. And it's really, truly is a really great film. And that's pretty much what I have to say with it at the moment. But I could go more into it, but like I said, I don't want to give too much away.
Mm. Yeah, I won't say too much either, as when I first saw this, and I have only seen it that one time, I didn't really know much about it going in. I really had almost no idea what it was about. I had always heard it referenced, but it was kind of something like I thought, well, I'll just sit and watch it. And it was on TV one day, so I made the effort and sat down and watched it. And I thought it was a really, really good film. It was interesting, but it was also very tragic. And I mean, by the end, it had really taken a lot out of me. But it was actually really interesting, because I thought it had really good, I mean, aside from Meryl Streep, I thought it had really, really strong performances from Kevin Klein, who you know, I, at that time, I'd always really seen him in a lot more comedic roles, and I hadn't really, you know, seen too much from McNichol either, and I thought it was a really interesting role for him as well. But as you said, I think it is worth checking out and, yeah, experiencing Sophie's Choice.
Yeah. Well, I've been on record before now as not being much of a Meryl Streep fan, you know, and finding her pretty comprehensively overrated. And I've been told that this is the film that's going to convert me, so I do have to get around to seeing it. But
I'll be interested to hear your thoughts when you do.
Yeah, I haven't yet, but I'm not a big Meryl Streep fan. Just showy, but there we go. Maybe this will turn me around completely, but we shall see.
We will see.
So I guess I'll let you know.
Yeah. That you will do. We'll back to me then?
Yes.
All right, something completely different. Having spent the last couple of weeks researching George A. Romero, I've gone with a 1982 film of his called Creepshow, which was a collaboration between Romero and Stephen King. And Creepshow is basically... it's a segment of shorter films tied together as one, in one big film rather, with in between each of the segments is another story in itself. And the film is like a homage to the old horror comics like Tales from the Crypt. So it's got a very horror comic book-ish feel to it, where the film actually begins... where we see a young boy called Billy, played by Stephen King's own son, and his abusive father basically tells him off for reading a horror comic called Creepshow. So his father basically tosses it out, trying to teach his son a lesson. And, you know, you see some of this stuff, and then we go back and we see... the first story coming out of the comic, which is called Father's Day, which is quite a popular, I think, little segment from the film, which I won't really go into all the details of every little story in there. However, Father's Day is interesting to note that a very young and with hair Ed Harris co-stars in the film. And it has a very interesting and memorable ending to that film, to that segment film, which whatever you want to be calling it. The next one is called The Lonesome Death of Geordie Beryl, and it solely stars Stephen King, who doesn't do too bad of a job with a performance. And this is a really strange little segment. And it's, I don't know, there's no way to really describe it again. You need to see that one. My favourite segment from the film is called Something to Tide You Over, and this one stars Leslie Nielsen and Ted Danson, and Leslie Nielsen plays an absolute psychopath who, you know, it is almost more serious role, and he does something really disturbing which has to do with Ted Danson, and by the end of it, I mean, I was just... it almost floored me. It was unbelievable, and it was really, really enjoyable. Like, I would basically watch that segment again, if anything. The final two, one's called The Crate, and the other one was called They're Creeping Up on You. I thought that they were not as good, but they were still rather entertaining, especially The Crate. Had some really, really interesting scenes. And, yeah, the final one absolutely grossed me out because it involved having a phobia of cockroaches. And yeah. I absolutely hate cockroaches, and they're showing up everywhere. And this is basically one of my really bad nightmares. And, you know, it it was pretty crazy. But E.G. Marshall was pretty fantastic in that segment. And then the film wraps up, sort of rounding up the original little bit at the beginning, where something really terrible happens to the abusive father, and you can see Tom Savini in a cameo. I have to say, Creepshow is actually a really fun movie. And I really think, like, you know, George Romero and Stephen King make a really great pairing. And I know that Romero, throughout his career, had tried to direct different adaptations of Stephen King's work, and he did eventually do that with a later film. But, you know, I almost think that if these two had paired up the way they wanted to, I think there would be a few more rather solid King adaptations. I mean, this is something I can easily recommend to check out, especially with how much I absolutely loved Something to Tide You Over, and it's such a great little performance from Leslie Nielsen. So I haven't seen any of the sequels, which, again, Romero didn't really have anything to do with, but this in itself is a really great little film. And that's me blubbing.
I really enjoyed the movie as well. I do have a soft spot for anthology horror movies because, you know, they're always a lot of fun.
Yeah, I enjoy them as well.
Yeah. And I did enjoy Creepshow, and it was really cool just seeing a lot of actors who, you know, eventually would go on to do bigger and better things in this film. Like you say, like Ed Harris, and also seeing Ted Danson in there as well. And Leslie Nielsen, like at the time, before I actually saw this movie, I only pretty much associated him with just comedies.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was really weird to actually see him, like, in a dramatic role and even, a psychopathic role.
Yeah, and I mean, he is really, really freaking good. I could almost have that short film as, you know, turned into a full-length film. That would have been fantastic.
Yeah. But I have to say, of the stories, I think my favourite one was The Crate, because it was, like, a really creepy sort of little movie, and it had the plot behind it was really interesting as well.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's all I have to say about Creepshow.
And I don't know if Sam has actually ever seen Creepshow.
I haven't. It's staring out of my VHS shelves at me just now. and I think I will probably include it, time permitting, with all of this, because it's LFF time, in my Shocktober series that I try and run every Halloween.
I hope you do get around to it. I mean, for me, it was almost like I sort of had bits and pieces that I'd seen, but it was really the first time I actually sat down to watch, and I'm glad I did.
Cool. I mean, it definitely sounds like a great deal of fun, and the Leslie Nielsen thing has my curiosity piqued, I've got to say.
It is a must-see, I have to. I mean, I was really surprised, and just really, really worth checking out for that.
But there's a few horror films I'm saving up kind of for October. So
So yeah, that's Creepshow.
Cool.
And Sam, your fourth pick.
Well, let's stick with horror movies then and talk about John Carpenter's The Thing, which I know everyone will have seen and I know everyone will be a fan of, I'm sure. This was an interesting one for me because the first time I saw it was only last year, and I saw it in kind of the perfect circumstances because it came back in a cleaned up digital print to cinemas over here for a 1-day re-release, and I saw it on that day. Same day I saw District 9, actually, I think, and maybe even 500 Days of Summer was that day as well. But it really blew me away seeing it for the first time in this crisp print on a beautiful big screen, in London. And I don't know, it's just a really, as much as it's a fun, gory, nasty little movie, with brilliant effects by Rob Bottin, what I really like about it, I've got to say, is, how atmospheric it is and how well it keeps the feel, the sort of claustrophobic feel of Howard Hawks and Christine Nivey's original, The Thing from Another World, because they're both very insular horror movies about this parasitic invader killing off people at an Arctic base, basically. And obviously that has really claustrophobic connotations because the characters literally can't go outside a lot of the time because unless they're, you know, very well protected and very well wrapped up, going outside will literally kill them in minutes. But obviously what people remember from this film is the special effects and the sort of gory, gruey, nasty stuff. And that's so brilliantly carried over. I'm quite looking forward to seeing this sort of remake, prequel, reboot thing that they're doing in October this year. I'm sort of cautiously going, oh, that could be interesting. But the problem, I think, is going to be that they'll be doing those effects in CGI. And the practical stuff, even if it's sometimes clunky, and I don't think it is here, it has weight and it has presence in a way that CGI still can't do. You know, when you see that head turn itself upside down and grow legs, it's shocking because that's what's actually happening. Mm. You know, it's this thing that they've created and it's going through these contortions. I'm doing mime and I don't know why because we're not filming this. And it's going through these contortions and the sound effects are brilliant as well, that sort of creaking and breaking that it does. And it's really there. And that's why it's so disgusting as well. And it's just brilliant. It's really, you know, all those incredibly memorable gory sequences and effects sequences, you know, the chest suddenly developing teeth and cutting off somebody's hands, you know, the big thing at the end, the possessed dogs, all of this stuff, brilliantly realized by a team, largely Rob Bottin, but I know they had, I think, Screaming Mad George came on and did some stuff, and Stan Winston as well. And you can really tell that this is kind of an all-star team at work here. It's also just a really fun movie. There's a lot of nice dialogue between, you know, Kurt Russell doing the sort of tough, grizzled guy who's come to take care of this situation sort of thing. And I like the sort of interactions and the suspicion that surrounds everyone. You know, is this guy the thing? Is that guy the thing? And also the bleakness of it, of the ending, I think is terrific. Yeah, so there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening in it, I think. And, it's just a great 80s horror movie.
I think I've said it before, probably many times even, that this is one of my all-time favorite films, not just horror films, and I think it's the best film of John Carpenter. And for me, I think it's one of the best, if not the best, performances from Kurt Russell and his epic beard.
It is a very, very high quality beard.
It is.
That is fine, fine chin furniture there.
Yeah. And I basically, you know, I've seen this movie many, many times. It's still as great as the first time, and I've shown it to many people who absolutely became obsessed, just as I did when they saw it. I have the poster above my bed because I love it so much. And, you know, it's funny, a number of the films that we've discussed have beautiful artwork by Drew Struzan, so that's also cool.
You should do a podcast about that guy, actually, a Drew Struzan podcast.
I have been thinking about it, to tell you the truth. So I keep saying, I want to stop that. So yeah, The Thing. I think it's just, yeah, for me, it's a cinematic masterpiece. There's nothing wrong with it at all. And I'm very jealous. I would love to see this on the big screen. I'm hoping that one day it'll come out here to be able to see on the screen again, as there are a
Yeah, I
few
mean,
cinemas
I
that
think
do show
that's
older
the
stuff.
reason that I really got into it, because, I mean, it's such a perfect way to see a movie like this, because you do need to kind of see it in good quality and on a large screen for it to have the full impact, for the effects to, you know, have their full potential realized, I think.
Yeah, and the effects look, they look so real, realistic, fantastic. I mean, I can't say enough good things about how great that they still hold up. Like
They do. They
they
still hold
really
up
did
pretty
such a
well.
great They did such a great
Absolutely.
job, there's no question. And
Indeed.
yeah, that's me from about the thing.
The Thing, it is awesome. That's all I need to basically say about it, because you guys pretty much said everything.
As good as it is, it's also well worth seeing The Thing from Another World, I would say.
Although,
That's
as much as I do
cool.
like that movie as well, but I don't think it really gives that sense of paranoia that John Carpenter's take on the material did. Because
Yeah, I think there's no question that the remake in this case is better. But
it's
I really
worth
like
checking
the
out.
first film. And there's also a good remake of it in the first season of The X-Files, which is called Ice.
I don't remember that, and I have seen those early X-Files. I'll have to track that down, actually.
I think I recall that one, but that was like a long ass time ago. Alrighty. My next film is a little movie that I used to watch all the time when I was a kid, and it used to scare the absolute shit out of me.
Grease
Not
too.
because, you know, but actually, this film wasn't even a horror movie. It's actually a family film. And that is The Dark Crystal.
The
Oh, fair point.
Dark Crystal.
The Dark Crystal is like,
The
if you saw this
dark
movie as a kid, you would have nightmares for like a long up. For a long, long time. It is, because it's like a really creep, not like creepy, but it's a very, well, no pun intended, it's a dark movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen this for a very long time, and I do remember it from my childhood.
Yeah.
There's not much I could probably add to what you're going to say because it's been that long, but I really actually would like to check it out again, and I've sort of had it in my mind that I've wanted to, so at least
Yeah.
it's a good reminder now, so I'll let you talk about it.
Well, I'm looking. Well, the film sort of follows our the cat follows a little guy named Jen, who's the last of a race of beings called the Gelfling. Well, he thinks he's the last of a race of creatures called the Gelflings, and he sort of tries to stay hidden and tries to get out of the way of one of the more domineering species that run the planet, called the just trying to remember how the name was pronounced, the Yersex, I think that's what they're called. I could be wrong, so I could be butchering the name as we speak, but yeah, they're the and they've taken over this castle that's home to the Dark Crystal. Oh, well, not the Dark Crystal, it's a crystal that sort of oh shit, I've It's been a while since I've seen the movie, so yeah, little
You're doing
once again.
the description the way I did first time.
I know it's I'm really terrible. Let's just say little guy has to become a hero and to stop the bad guys from, you know, taking over the planet. That's basically it. Well, there's a thing like where he has to find this piece of crystal that has been missing from this bigger crystal that the Ursex are keeping guarded, and that way that will destroy them. So he has to go on a journey to find that, and along the way he finds another Gelfling by the name of Kira. And along the way they sort of go on an adventure, find, and they have to pretty much, it's go off, find this crystal, and hopefully they can get rid of the Cersex once and for all by placing this this shard of crystal back into this bigger crystal. I think it's that's the only way I can describe it, really. By bringing, like, getting rid of them and bringing peace back towards the land. So, yeah. Actually, it wasn't the sex that had taken over the planet. It was the... So I'm butchering this movie. I'm so sorry. And I only saw it... I only rewatched it, like, a few years ago. I'm butchering it as we speak. So, yes. But, yeah, if you want to know more about this movie, go to the Wikipedia page. But other than trying to explain the plot in a very terrible way, but it is a great movie. It's made by directed by Jim Henson and Frank Oz. Mm-hmm. And I do remember, because like at the time Jim Henson was only making just the Muppet movies at the time, and this was something that he wanted to do for a long time. And I do remember recalling that the movie wasn't actually a big hit at the time, because it was actually some audiences actually thought it was too dark.
Yeah, too it was scary quite a lot darker, ones. Yeah,
and but other than that, it is still a really great film. Like, all the creatures in the film are very well designed. The production design is amazing. Score, I guess the puppeteering work and the vocal performances are amazing, and if you haven't seen The Dark Crystal, it's definitely worth checking out, especially if you do love Jim Henson, because like as much as you know we all love the Muppet movies, but his other stuff, sort of like his more sort of slightly darker stuff, like you know, this one and also Labyrinth, are all all worth checking out. And this film, like, I rewatched it again a few years ago, and it still holds up immensely. So if you're thinking about checking out this movie again, do so. It's still a great movie.
Yeah, I think it needs a watch, and maybe it'll make more sense than what you've just described.
I know.
I wouldn't count on it, as far as I recall.
Yes.
But I don't think I've seen it since I was about 12. So I really need to go back and revisit it. I do have it on disc. I've got it's the only Superbit DVD that I own, because I found that knocking around in a second-hand shop.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just going to say, like, back a couple of years ago, they had, like, a 25th anniversary edition, which was loaded with special features. And also the movie, as like 2 years ago, had also been released on Blu-ray as well.
Yeah, so I imagine it's going to look great, because actually I have seen the original puppets, because they used to be in the Museum of the Moving Image here in London.
Nice.
Some of them. So I've actually seen the original puppets up close, and the detail you just would not believe. So I would really think it looks tremendous on Blu-ray.
Nice.
It does. Like, I'm at Blu-ray.com like now, and I'm actually looking at the screenshots of the Blu-ray, and it does look fantastic. Although it was kind of scary although I have to admit, when I did rewatch the movie a few years ago, the character of Jen, I kind of was kind of really creeped out by the fact that he kind of looks like Michael Jackson. just less pale up, less pale up.
God.
I know, but even like I said, it is like it is kind of a like if you actually watch the movie, like like looking back, like when I rewatched it a few years ago, it still holds up and it's a great film. But I can definitely see now, as I'm older, like why I would be freaked out by the movie as a kid, because there are some really, really sort of creepy images and really creepy creatures in the film, like the Sekus, whatever the name is, the villains of the story. The Sketsies, yes, that's it. That's how it was. Pronounced, sorry everybody, but the Sketsies, like how they're designed are really very frightening, And they kind of look like really, really very dark looking like vultures. And it.
Well, there's like, definitely a sort of Grim Reaper influence to them as well, I think. You know, there's very much that sort of aura about them.
Yeah, and but they are creepy. And,
but those are the costumes that that I saw in Museum of the Moving Image, which is gone now, sadly. But yeah, they're stunning.
Yeah, nice. So I think we could all, like I said, you guys probably haven't seen The Dark Crystal in a while, but I definitely do say it's worth revisiting right now. So
cool.
Another one to revisit.
Indeed.
Yeah, visit and revisit. This is just my list of films to see, you know, which is already longer than both my arms.
Yeah, my list of things to watch new or rewatch is insane.
It's depressing. I've got so much to do.
Yes, so much to do, so little time.
Tell me about it.
All right. Well, I think we'll move on to Marcy's final pick.
Yep, and my final pick is a little movie called Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Khan!
Yeah, this is everyone's cue to go, Khan!
Khan! This movie is
Has everyone got it out of their system now?
I think I'm fine for now. This movie is pretty much my favorite Star Trek movie. And I think it is the
controversial.
Best.
Oh, hang on, no.
No. It's my, not only is it my favourite, personally, but it is the film I think is the best Star Trek film. And it introduces Khan. Khan! Again, had to say it. It introduces Khan. And he was a character previously seen on an original episode of the original series. And Khan was, let me go think back to the storyline, just to put it in perspective. In the Star Trek universe, back in the early or mid-1990s or 90s, they had the genetics where they would try and genetically engineer humans to be better than they were, which caused the eugenics wars. I'm a bad Trekkie for not remembering any of this very well, but and basically him and a whole bunch of people were put in a space pod craft. It's been so long since I've seen the original episode. So basically through this whole episode, a lot of stuff happens and Kirk maroons them on a planet. And as this film happens, they come across one of the other planets. And I can't remember, it's been a little while since I've seen it, but this leads one of the crew members, which happens to be Chekhov, with the nuclear vessels, which are not in this movie, but I wanted to say it anyway. He goes onto this planet and they find out that they marooned that the marooned people were not on the original planet that they suspected. And Khan is finding this as his opportunity to get the revenge on Captain Kirk. So this is very much a back and forth between those two men. And there's a lot of interesting questions raised about a lot of different elements, far too many to go into, but it's such an intelligent movie. It's very, very exciting. It's very raw in what it wants to say. They did such a great job where they had this one set that they managed to use for two different ships and it looked completely different. And I think Ricardo Montalban in this movie had the most amazing chest in the history of chests.
I wish I had that chest.
I think every male should want that chest.
Especially for, like, his age, man. Like, damn.
Yes, for reals. Like, his
voice is more remarkable than his chest, to be honest. The voice is really cool.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt, I agree. But, yeah, I mean, What can one say?
Exactly.
There isn't much else to say. But, you know, I mean, besides that, there's not much else to say. It's just an absolutely fantastic film. And I mean, yeah, you sort of need to be familiar, but at the same time, not overly, because you're introduced to the characters and it explains the situation really well. So, yeah, I mean...
No, I'm not remotely a Trekkie, but this is one of the ones that I do remember enjoying. I've never got people's enthusiasm for four, to be honest. Like, oh, save Wales with some Star Trek. No. But it's this and six, for me, I think are just excellent. The others I can kind of take or leave. But two and six are really solid, interesting, thematically quite rich sci-fi films. You know, whether they're Star Trek or not, they're just really interesting sci-fi, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can definitely get behind this one.
I agree with you. I think with the original six, my two personal favourites are 2 and 6 as well. I don't even know what to say. I was just like, oh, this is awesome. And yeah, I'll just leave it. I was like, yeah, it's fucking awesome.
And, I agree. Although I have a very big soft spot for number 4 because that to me was the most hilarious of the series. But, you know, that's a whole different story altogether. But number 2 is pretty awesome. And yeah, it's definitely worth seeing.
Surely 5 is the funniest.
Five is not good. Yeah, 5 is not good.
Number 4 was funny for the right reasons. So, yeah. Anyways.
I love the awkwardness of this podcast.
Our transitions are always so smooth when I do this podcast. It's great.
Sam, your final pick.
Okay, bit of a change of pace. No, you know, yelling and jokes here. Because I'm going to talk a bit about Costa Gavras' film Missing, which actually shared the Palme d'Or in 1982. And it's a very serious, very dramatic film with Sissy Spacek and Jack Lemmon as respectively the wife and father of a young writer who has gone missing during a military coup in an unnamed South American country. It's obviously Pinochet's Chile, but they just don't say it. You know, because I imagine that would have been quite controversial at the time, but it's not even a difficult analogue. It's Chile, but they haven't said it. What really strikes me about Missing is it's just such a, without being explicitly violent or anything like that, it's a really brutal and hard-hitting film, just as a drama. You've got these two people who are kind of thrown together by this circumstance who don't really see eye to eye. You know, Jack Lemmon's kind of a conservative, you know, upstanding American citizen type, whereas his son and his son's wife, Sissy Spacek, are much more sort of liberal and have gone off to South America to, you know, live a different kind of life. And the two of them kind of collide in this way when they're thrown together when his son goes missing. And the process of them trying to find him is very painstakingly and very movingly portrayed. The performances are fantastic. Spacek and I think Lemmon were both nominated for Oscars. I can't imagine who beat Sissy Spacek that year, to be honest, but...
Meryl Streep.
Oh, yes, fair enough. Well, I haven't seen Sophie's Choice, but gosh, I would imagine it's a pretty close run thing there. But it's brilliantly performed and brilliantly shot as well by Costa Gavras. There's one scene in this sort of in this football stadium where a lot of the kidnapped people have been taken, and this mass of people, and Jack Lemmon is allowed to call out for his son, and the just the, this unmoving mass of people is so striking, and the way Gavras shoots that, and also later the same sort of unmoving mass of bodies as well. It's kind of an angry film, but not in a sort of not in a way that punches you in the face with its politics. You know, it's a very engaged, very interesting film, but also one that you can kind of just view as a drama. I think I take more away from it every time I see it. And it's one of the films that really turned me on to just how good both Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek are, or were, oh, yeah, in Lemmon's case.
Yeah. I actually saw the movie for the first time last year, and I do agree. It is a very, very powerful film. I didn't know what to expect from it, because I just heard, like, oh, it was like a Best Picture nominee from its respective year, and I thought, okay, well, and I'm sort of on a mission to try to see as many Best Picture nominated films as possible, so I checked it out, and I was kind of blown away, and I was blown away by it. It is very powerful, very emotional, and I do agree, like, the performances are amazing, and I was especially really impressed by Jack Lemmon, and even though I love Jack Lemmon as an actor, this is definitely one, a very different role for of him that I have seen from him, and he just completely nails it. He is just perfect in every way.
I love how much you see him as this proud man who's kind of reduced scene upon scene upon scene by this bureaucracy that he's trying to get through to try and find his son. And he seems to become smaller as a man throughout the film. It's a really beautifully subtle piece of acting.
Yeah.
And Spacek talks a lot about it on her Inside the Actors Studio, and particularly how he would tell her to do less, which I think is not advice that she particularly needed from her other performances, but it certainly paid off here.
That's true, and it is an amazing film, and it's not really talked about, which is kind of a shame, because it's sort of one of those undiscovered gems, even despite the fact that it is a Best Picture-nominated film, and it did win an Oscar. I think it was for either original or adapted screenplay, I can't remember, but if our audience out there hasn't seen Missing, it's just go out and find it. It's just worth it.
And it does sort of... Criterion put it out recently in the US, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Or have put it out in the US.
Oh, okay, cool. So if it's released by Criterion, then it's worth checking out. Because they only release quality.
Except in the case of
Armageddon.
Yeah, I was going to say, except in the case of Armageddon.
Oh, well, that's like awesome in its own way, but that's a whole different story altogether. But
Michael Bay.
Marcy, what do you think of Quiet Marcy? I'm going to say
Quiet Marcy. Now speak, Marcy.
Marcy, I'm going to use my pimp hand on you if you're out of control. Nah, I'm only joking.
Do I need to unleash Mistress Marcy on you?
Yes, Mistress Marcy. Ow!
Couldn't be a podcast without a Mistress Marcy reference.
Of course. But Marcy, what do you? Will you be checked? Have you seen Missing?
I have not. I have wanted to see it. Stop humming, Marcy. I'll have to Mistress Marcy on myself, apparently. Ow. Okay. Again with the arm. No, I have not seen the film. I said arm again.
See, now that you know that you're doing it, you're going to keep doing it.
Yes. I have not seen the film. I would really like to see the film. And now that I'm aware of it being a Criterion, it shouldn't be too hard to track down and watch. So you've both very much convinced me. On the film, so
yes. I think my... Well, I have one little honourable mention before I go into my final pick, only because this movie, I want to give a shout-out to it, but I haven't seen it in a while.
Conan the Barbarian.
Sorry?
Conan the Barbarian.
No.
Oh, damn.
but this one is The Verdict, which starred Paul Newman, which is a great little sort of courtroom drama that was written by David Mamet and directed by the late, great Sidney Lumet, which features definitely one of... Yes. That's all you pretty much need to know about this movie. It was like nominated for a few Oscars. Didn't win any, but some people thought that this could have been the film that Paul Newman would have finally won that his Oscar for. But, you know, he was up against Ben Kingsley for Gandhi that year. So it was a bit hard to top that amazing performance as well. But, yeah, The Verdict, a really amazing film that you should all check out. Okay, my final movie... I think we can't really talk about 1982 without talking about probably the biggest movie of 1982, even though we have talked about it on previous podcasts, and that, of course, is E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Yes, we have talked about it.
I know, but, yeah. But
it was, I believe, it was the highest-grossing film of that year.
Indeed.
I think it was, at that point, the highest-grossing film of all time.
I believe it was the highest rated PG film until like Jurassic Park, which funnily enough also happened to be a Spielberg film.
So yeah, that's weird because he never makes big money makers otherwise.
Yeah, no. I know, man.
Not at all, right?
He makes all those
so inconsistent commercially.
Yes, he makes all those little indie movies that nobody ever sees, like Jaws and. But anyways, what can you say about E.T. that hasn't already been said, like whether on this podcast or in life in general?
Avoid the game from Atari.
You can think of a few things, but you probably don't want to hear them.
I have said this on a podcast. If you do... Audience, if you know somebody who doesn't love E.T., it's your duty to punch that person in the face because this movie needs to be loved by everyone. What do you need to say?
Is that all you have to say about that?
It's a good thing that you can't reach across the planet, really, Bede, because, I have an affection for it, but I'm not sure it's the movie people think it is.
Sam, you're like the most terrible person that has ever been on this podcast, even more terrible than me.
Nobody's more terrible than you.
I am the evil Englishman.
Exactly. You're the evil, evil Englishman. So, yes. Sam, you need to go rewatch this movie right now and bask in its awesomeness.
I actually don't have it because the DVD here was, I think, only released with that stupid altered print.
Oh, okay.
Replaced all the guns with the fucking walkie-talkies. I refuse. I refuse.
Yeah, that's retarded.
I'm not seeing it again until I can see it in its proper form.
Mm.
Well, apparently,
I may not love E.T. the way that a lot of people do, but I have enough respect for it that I don't want to see it fucked with.
Like I said on a previous podcast, they removed the walkie-talkies, but yet they kept the penis breath line, so, yeah. Which was in the movie.
Yeah, that's mind-boggling.
I know. Like, you will never catch a line in that line in any kids' movies today, I can assure you of that.
It was inserted to make sure that the film got a PG because G-rated films weren't doing as well at the box office as PG-rated films, so they wanted to make it PG, hence penis breath.
I'd just like to see, like, who was in that sort of... meeting room who came up with the idea. I know how we can make this not a G-rated movie. Let's use the live penis breath. That'll give the movie.
There's a lot of Hollywood meetings I'd like to have been in, but yes, that one would have been funny.
Yes, but E.T., like I said, it is a masterpiece and it's one of the most loved movies of all time. And I assume it will, like, since Jaws is coming out on Blu-ray next year, I assume that E.T. will be following suit. And knowing Spielberg, it will be the original version, because I did read an interview saying the other day that of the two versions, he wants us, the audience, to watch, he would rather we watch the original version. So I assume that version will come out on Blu-ray maybe next year, but who knows?
Hopefully,
it'd be nice to revisit it, I've got to say, because I do have affection for it from when I was a kid. It's not like I think it's some sort of terrible movie. It's a good movie. It's just I don't have quite the reverence for it that some do.
Well, I have to admit, I didn't actually have for it at the time when I was a kid, but it wasn't until I actually was older that I truly appreciated the movie for what it is. So, yeah, but other than that, that's all I really need to say about E.T., because we've already covered it on multiple episodes of the show.
I don't think I have anything more to add about E.T., so...
Yeah. I think we might wrap this all up.
Indeed.
Yes, I'm happy that Sam has joined us for this preemptive podcast.
Preemptive? What? Well, you mean impromptu?
Yeah, impromptu, that's what I meant to say.
But... He's at least said 3-on-2.
No, I didn't say preemptive. I said preemptive.
Impromptu.
Well, mangling the English language, you Australian bastard.
All right, well, I am happy that Sam joined us for this last-minute podcast.
There you go.
And as well, Marcy, too, for...
putting up with your terribleness.
Yes, but... and for putting up with my terrible plot description of the Dark Crystal, which would be, like, the worst thing ever in the history of all things in a worst thing. Before we end the show for tonight, I might ask where we can find everyone on the internet right now.
Well, you can find me giggling at Bede's plot descriptions. but for real, you can find us always at justsupermarcy.com, where we do lots of awesome things, and hopefully there will be even more awesome things coming up, which I'm not at liberty to discuss right now because I want them to actually work out first. And you can basically go on Twitter and follow Super Marcy or look up Super Podcast on Facebook or just look up Marcy and sure enough, one of those search results will be me.
Exactly.
In other words, Sam, you're bloody everywhere.
Basically, yes.
Yes.
You're infecting the internet like an Australian virus.
Indeed.
Exactly.
Now, Sam, where will we find you on the internet?
You can find my site at 24fps.org.uk, or you can find me writing at multimediamouth.com, and you can also find me on Twitter. I don't do the Facebook thing, but you can find me on Twitter at 24fpsuk.
And Bede, where can we find you?
You can find me butchering the English language on a regular basis. And as well, butchering the plot summary of Jim Henson movies. But you can also find me on Twitter at twitter.com/BedeJamine, or my Facebook page at facebook.com/BedeJamine, or my Movie Fan Central page at moviefancentral.com/TerraAustralis, or... You can also ask me a question on why English is not my second language.
Again, do you mean not your first language? Because not your second language makes less sense.
Anyway. Yes, you can find me butchering even my first language. You can ask me that at vu.com/BedeJamine. And also you can find my weekly writings at supermarcy.com for my movie song of the week or my recommendations of the week, which are much more better written than me speaking.
I am much more better written than my speaking.
Yes. Yes, because my written words are way better than my words. I don't know. Anyways, let's end the show and get back to normality right now. Okay. Good. I'll see you. Night, everybody.
Catch you later, everyone.
Cheers, everyone. See you around.